Welcome to this special WERU presentation from the 2018 Camden Conference. I'm Jim Campbell. The theme of the 31st Annual Camden Conference, held in February of 2018 in Camden, Maine, was New World Disorder and America's Future. Our presentation from the conference on today's program is by Chaz Freeman, Jr., who served for over 30 years in the U.S. State and Defense Departments in a variety of countries, including India, Taiwan, Thailand, China, as ambassador to Saudi Arabia, where he was posted during Operation Desert Storm, and as Principal Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs. Ambassador Freeman's presentation at the 2018 Camden Conference was entitled, "This Too Shall Pass." Following his presentation, we'll hear excerpts from a question and answer session in which he participated. The moderator for this year's conference was Indira Lakshmanan, who is the Newmark Chair in Journalism Ethics at the Poynter Institute. For many years, she reported from the U.S. and from 80 other countries for major news organizations including Bloomberg, the International New York Times, NPR, PBS, and the Boston Globe, where she continues to write a regular column on foreign policy and politics. We join her now as she introduces Ambassador Freeman.
I want to introduce our next speaker. He's retired Ambassador Chaz Freeman, and really do read his bio, but I need to pull out for you my favorite part of Chaz Freeman's bio, which is during Richard Nixon's first trip to China in 1972, Chaz Freeman was his interpreter. I mean, I don't know, when you've at a young age achieved that on your bio or your resume, I think you can pretty much retire. Having been a Nixon in China's translator is pretty cool. But he did go on to become ambassador to Saudi Arabia, and he also was assistant secretary of defense. He speaks fluent Chinese, French, Spanish, and Arabic, so top that. And he is now a scholar associated with Brown University, and he's gonna speak to us now. Thank you, Ambassador.
Thank you, Indira. I've been to the Camden Conference several times before, and the reason I came back is not only because I'm a maniac, but I really think this is one of the greatest examples of citizen engagement in our country, and I wish there were a lot more of it. Having said that, Natalie is a really hard act to follow, and I'm glad I made it to the podium, however. Years ago, a friend of mine asked Linus Pauling, who was then in his 90s, and as you know, he got two Nobel Prizes, one for chemistry and one for peace, what the secret of longevity was. My friend thought he was going to talk about vitamin C or something, but he said, never let go of the handrail. So there isn't one, but here I am. The United States declared its independence 242 years ago, and we did so on a planet in which China was one-third of the global economy, but geopolitics were dominated by Britain, the world's greatest naval power, and France, which had the finest army and the most brilliant culture on the Eurasian landmass at the time. After a struggle in which our war for independence played a part, Britain emerged as the global superpower. As a well-known map shows, it's it's easier to depict the countries Britain did not invade than to identify those it did. In any event, after 1815, the rules of the world order were written in English. The United States prospered in the British-led international system. By about 1875, we had become the world's largest economy. In the early 20th century, the United States began to displace Britain in its global dominion. initially reluctant to lead, Americans' belated but successful engagement in World War II made us the dominant power in every corner of the globe other than those within the Soviet Empire. Our establishment rose to the challenge. Since 1945, the world has been regulated by norms, obligations, and conventions mostly made in the USA. As the Cold War unfolded, American diplomacy became a kind of imperial administration designed to secure the frontiers of our sphere of influence and keep order within what we called, somewhat disingenuously, the free world. U.S. allies, partners, and client states relied on the United States to provide the bulk of their collective security against Soviet predation. We supplied security, regime support, and reconstruction and development aid. In return, they tolerated the exorbitant privilege of dollar supremacy and allowed Americans to exempt ourselves from the rules we insisted on applying to them and everyone else. In foreign lands, the United States preached that all men are created equal. At home, we practiced racial segregation. Abroad, we declined to ratify multilateral treaties we had proposed, even as we held others to the standards in those treaties. Americans demanded international courts, but made ourselves immune from their jurisdiction. We ignored and fell far short of the targets for development aid we ourselves proclaimed. Since 1991, when the Soviet Union imploded and the Cold War ended, the United States has continued to expect the same deference and exemptions from the standards we apply to other countries as before. American military power remains uniquely formidable. The U.S. military bestrides the globe. But American power no longer serves to defend allies, partners, and friends against a common enemy on behalf of jointly defined interests. By the 21st century, the United States armed forces turned to unilateral American agendas. Washington replaced its previous emphasis on supporting cooperative regimes, regardless of their character or ideology. It replaced that with a fixation on regime change in the name of democratization or other ideologically or special interest-driven agendas. Americans greatly reduced our development assistance. We turned our energies to the maintenance of our global military primacy while cutting our investment in all other aspects of foreign affairs. For more than two centuries, American exceptionalism had appealed to the angels of humanity's better nature. But as the 21st century advanced, foreigners began to see American claims to political privilege and demands for legal immunity as instances of assertive irresponsibility. The result is steadily reduced foreign support for the hegemonic privileges and double standards to which Americans had come to feel entitled. Today, the American conviction that other countries should be grateful to us and supportive of our continuing global primacy clashes with the preference of every other great power for a multipolar world in which there is no single world policeman. We Americans can and should be proud of what we accomplished when we led the world. Our leadership institutionalized international norms that helped expand human liberty, foster unity to deter aggression, deal with the causes and consequences of conflict, retard the spread of nuclear weapons, and share the burdens of doing all these things among like-minded nations. American initiatives created institutions that enabled the world to harmonize the rules governing international transactions, lower barriers to trade and investment, promote economic growth and efficiency, lift billions of people out of poverty, improve corporate governance, facilitate the peaceful resolution of commercial disputes, and respond to systemic shocks that threaten global prosperity. We will not be alone in missing these fruits of the Pax Americana. In February 2018, given the 13-month-long festival of unintended consequences, that is the Trump administration, few still see the challenge to global order as managing the consequences of the steady expansion of other nations' power in relation to the United States. The world is now concerned to mitigate and offset the knock-on effects of the rapid contraction of American global influence. The 20th century was rightly called the American century. The United States has turned its back on it and is in a messy transition to something else. As the Canadian-American band Buffalo Springfield put it at another troubled moment of transition in 1966, there's something happening here. What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there telling me I got to beware. It's time we stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. Now as American global dominion recedes into history, we can begin to see some elements of what is to come. If the 20th century was America's, the 21st will be nobody's. We are witnessing a return to a world based on regional, not global, balances of power. America first invites China first, India first, Japan first, Pakistan first, Russia first, maybe Europe first if there is a Europe. Great power rivalries are back, some of them between nations with nuclear weapons. None wants to shoulder the burdens of global hegemony on the American model. None seeks to impose its own model on the world, but all are arming to preserve their sovereignty, often against the perceived threat of American attempts at regime change. War is back as an accepted means of adjusting the policies, borders, and international alignments of nations. Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, and Syria have been thrust into anarchy by foreign intervention. Israel is swallowing all of Palestine. Serbia has lost Kosovo. Ukraine has lost the Crimea. A Saudi-led Arab coalition is devastating Yemen. International law has been reduced to an instrument of accusatory diatribe. It no longer regulates national behavior. The reversion to the lawlessness of the pre-modern era is now well advanced. The armed forces of the United States are directly or indirectly engaged in combat with Muslim militants in 76 countries, often without regard for their sovereignty. Nations like China, India, Russia, and Turkey are joining Americans and the ex-imperial powers of Europe in establishing bases abroad from which they can project their military power to regions remote from them. Once quiescent client states like Egypt, Israel, Saudi Arabia, Turkey, and the United Arab Emirates are on their own warpaths without regard to the policies of their American patrons or once respected principles of international law. The new world disorder is one in which all fights are local. Might commonly makes right. Refugees are plentiful, and American charitable responses to human misery are newly wanting. Meanwhile, the central institutions of transnational cooperation like the United Nations, the World Bank, the World Trade Organization are atrophying under the impact of American disinterest, disengagement, and disinvestment. As Washington's abdication of its previous role in global governance has become ever more obvious, China and others have begun to create organizations to complement and parallel those Americans set up after World War II. Thus have been born the BRICS Bank, the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank, and a host of special funds directed at supporting connectivity on the Eurasian landmass under China's Belt and Road Initiative. The continuing U.S. retreat from forming, leading, or supporting multilateral structures and arrangements is taking a toll on American prestige and abetting stagnation in legacy institutions. It invites their replacement or sidelining by groupings from which the United States is absent. And as we all know, if you're not at the table, you're on the menu. The so-called liberal, rule-bound international order is not dying, as some claim. It is evolving through a process that is not being managed or led by the United States or any other Western power. Influence within the current international state system is proportional to the investment, effort, and input made by its members, not the past credentials or status of any single nation or grouping of nations. Increasingly, the crucial investments, efforts, and inputs come from China, India, and other rising powers outside the North Atlantic region. This is a break from the pattern of the last five centuries, in which various nations, including latterly the United States, ran things pretty much everywhere. It raises the question of how much of the old order will be incorporated into the international state system of the future. For like all instances of entropy in human affairs, the current world disorder will in due course yield to organization. Who organizes the new system, and how great a role Americans have in doing so will depend in part on the quality of our vision, statecraft, and diplomatic engagement. We can command our fate if we put our minds, skills, money, and other resources to shaping it. The United States has not lost our natural endowment, which remains unmatched. We still have everything it takes to shape the world to our advantage. We are remarkably diverse. As Herman Melville observed, if you kill an American, you shed the blood of the whole world. Our universities are widely considered the world's best. We have a heritage of freedom and a record of resilience and invention. We are again the world's greatest producer of energy. Americans make up at most 1/24 of the world's people, but possess about 1/8 of its cropland and water supplies. To our east and west, we are sheltered by two great oceans. Until recently, we enjoyed untroubled relationships with our neighbors to the north and south, who saw no reason to turn against us. We've been able to call on allies everywhere to add their strength to ours in pursuit of common objectives. But on every level, other than the promiscuous use of force, we are now underperforming. One wag has suggested that in some admittedly superficial ways, we've come to resemble Haiti in the 1920s. We have a populist president surrounded by plutocrats, and our country is run by the US Marines. We do not deserve the boorish epithet our president recently applied to Haiti any more than it did. But sadly, we are no longer a society that others seek to emulate. We're in the midst of an American version of the great proletarian cultural revolution, the great plutocratic cultural reaction. The 21st century has subverted our republic and corroded our democracy. The shock and awe of 9/11 panicked us into curtailing American liberties in the name of preserving them. The Congress supinely surrendered to the president its constitutionally exclusive power to authorize wars of choice. Successive presidents have launched an unending series of military campaigns under the heading of the Global War on Terrorism. They have financed and continue to finance these consistently unsuccessful interventions through what amount to credit rollovers. This practice has eroded the general welfare. If you drive from Portland up here, as I did, and as I did many years ago to come to this forum when the podium was over there, you are struck by the deterioration in our infrastructure. The uncontrolled expansion of public debt threatens an ultimate systemic collapse of the American economy and the society it sustains. We look to everyone else to deal with the refugees our botched military interventions have displaced. Then we disparage those who respond for their foolish generosity. Few Americans realize that over the past quarter century, the United States has been responsible, directly or indirectly, for the premature deaths of 4 million Muslims. This is a major reason for the metastasis of anti-American terrorism with global reach. Blowback from the havoc we are imposing abroad now disturbs our domestic tranquility. This has led to the further serious impairment of due process and civil liberty in the United States and elsewhere. We Americans now seem to be entering one of our periodic red scares, recalling the xenophobia and hysteria of the Palmer raids of 1919 to 1921 and the McCarthy era of 1947 to 57. As a nation, we are in a whiny, belligerent frame of mind. We blame Russia for the way we vote. We're working ourselves into a frenzy of machismo over China. We blame everybody but ourselves for the mess in the Middle East, for our trade and balance of payments deficits, and for the deindustrialization of our job market. We're dismissive of expertise, especially that of economists, the majority of whom tell us that our problems derive from our pathetically inadequate national savings rate, our disinvestment in our human and physical infrastructure, a dysfunctional relationship between labor and management that favors outsourcing to countries with cheap labor as a reaction to competition, shortcomings in the way we retrain and find employment for workers displaced by automation, rising income inequality, irrational immigration policies, the rake-offs and misdirection of investment by a tax code designed to nurture and protect vested interests, and gridlocked government. It's far easier to blame foreigners in China, Mexico, Canada, Germany, Korea, or Japan for our underachievement than to examine and change our own policies and practices. But successful foreigners are not the ones with the savings, trade, and investment shortfalls. We are. Insisting that foreigners do things our way might infect them with our problems. It will not fix those problems, nor will declaring China or others adversaries and hence active candidates to become enemies in future wars make us safer. Taking names is no substitute for cogent and persuasive argumentation on international issues on which we've become isolated. The answer to Chinese mercantilism, protectionism, and techno-nationalism cannot be petty-minded American obsession with bilateral trade balances, bigger-than-neighbor economic nationalism, or xenophobic investment controls. We Americans need to pull our socks up and show that we can compete on our own terms. And what are those terms? As part of preparing ourselves for the future, we must decide what elements of the so-called liberal rule-bound international order we consider it worth making a serious effort to restore or perpetuate. What instruments of statecraft might enable us to make these principles and practices part of the future as well as the past? How should we comport ourselves to accomplish this? What must we be prepared to propose or oppose? The most precious elements of the world we are exiting were its predictability, the sense of personal and collective safety this supported, and the openings for the realization of individual and social societal potential that this afforded. The international state system promoted comity, that is, respect for one country for the sovereignty, laws, judicial decisions, and institutions of others. It also promoted cooperation between states. It was risk-averse. It applied a facsimile of the rule of law to its international participants, even those who, like the Chinese and Russians, came late to the rule-bound order American leadership had built, prospered in it, and saw their opportunities for the pursuit of happiness enlarged. This was the result of an array of rules that set standards for acceptable international behavior. In ancient times, it was said that the strong do what they can and the weak suffer what they must. The evolution of international law that we Americans led in the 20th century offered reassurance of protection to the weak as well as a warning to the strong. It helped damp down arms races. and limit the risk of aggression by larger states against their smaller neighbors. As the post-Cold War era began, Iraq began attempted to annex its smaller neighbor, Kuwait. Under U.S. leadership, the international community rallied to Kuwait's defense. It did so as a matter of principle, as well as of strategic interest. The United States now routinely denounces others for not observing rules we ourselves no longer obey. This is weakening constraints on the coercive behavior of states. The precedents we've set through our use of assassination, drones, cyber warfare, overt encouragement of insurrection in other countries, and the imposition of unilateral controls on trade and investment are encouraging other states to pursue their interests without regard to the rules we once championed. This is not in our interest, and not just because others, once they can, are likely to feel justified doing to us what we are doing to them. We cannot be sure that we will always have the upper hand in all circumstances. Properly understood, the golden rule is a security measure not to be lightly cast aside. The rule of law is Euro-American civilization's greatest contribution to world affairs. Its value is widely appreciated outside the Atlantic region, but in a world in which other traditions and values are growing in influence, its survival is not assured. Can societies that do not practice the rule of law at home really feel bound by it abroad? The notion of a rule-bound international order will surely not endure, still less prosper, if the United States and Europe are not united in supporting it. But for Europeans and others, Guantanamo symbolizes contemporary American contempt for due process and international law. The West will remain divided as long as the United States persists in our unilateral suspensions of the rules governing prisoners of war, official kidnapping, interrogation through torture, and detention without charge, not to mention disregard for the legality of wars of choice under both the United States Constitution and international law. American reaffirmation of the traditional values of Western civilization is both essential and urgent. Absent appropriate engagement, other values may well displace ours. Consider China's Belt and Road initiative in this context. China has put forward a grand strategy to apply its economic, commercial, financial, and diplomatic power to transform all of the Eurasian landmass into a single geoeconomic zone. This will involve trillions of dollars in investment in roads, railroads, pipelines, fiber optic cables, ports, airports, and industrial estates from the Azores to the Bering Strait and from Arkhangelsk to Colombo. It entails agreements for free trade, customs clearance, transport standards, and other harmonizations of law and regulations between 65 countries. China is setting up specialized courts to apply the standards embodied in these agreements to the resolution of commercial disputes in the new Eurasian geoeconomic zone. What law, what rules will these courts apply? We're talking about an area that embraces about two-thirds of the world's population and already accounts for two-fifths of its GDP. That's enough to determine much of the future world order. Will the United States be a participant or a bystander as this order is forged? Will we or will we not work with Europe and others to ensure that the legacy of Atlantic civilization is consolidated in Eurasia as it reforms, opens up, and peacefully develops into a single great region? Now, this brings me to a delicate point. An intelligence establishment that tells our leaders what they want to hear is worse than none at all. It enables delusional reasoning that misdirects policy planning to deal with the very real challenges our country faces. The American body politic has a bad habit of projecting our ambitions and fears onto others rather than seeing them as they are. And this can lead to premature and counterproductive uses of force. Consider the run-up to the 2003 invasion of Iraq with its confident but entirely bogus assertions about weapons of mass destruction, Al-Qaeda, and the inadequacy of intrusive UN inspections, as well as its attribution to Iraq's neighbors of a sense of threat from Iraq that they did not feel. Consider the politicians who still ceaselessly rant about Iranian nuclear weapons programs while every professional intelligence agency says these do not yet exist. Fake news now creates as well as repeats false intelligence. The world is suffering from hypocrisy fatigue. Our bloated defense budget has ceased to be a response to any realistic challenge to the United States or its interests. It's a jobs program in which more is always better, and justifications for spending inflate to absorb the funds available. Contrary to political rhetoric, our military is not undernourished, but every civilian element of our government is experiencing politicization and deprofessionalization. The deterioration in our foreign affairs capabilities stands out for its severity. We are in a period of transition to some sort of new world order. We can influence what it is or just accept what comes. Bravado, backed by whiz-bang weaponry and an empty wallet, will not shape things to our advantage. There are no military solutions to most of the challenges we face, but we're creating conditions in which diplomatic incompetence makes it ever more likely that we will have to put our military in play. We will have failed to explore, let alone exhaust, the diplomatic alternatives to doing so. You know, the old days were not as wonderful as we would all like to believe, but with the right leadership and effort on our part, the days to come need not be as bad as we now imagine. It's up to us to provide that leadership and mount that effort. And that's one of the reasons I thought the first 2 days of this conference and the emphasis on participation by citizens in the voting process, in politics, was so important and so right. I believe that thinking Americans know what must be done. Raise the national savings rate, boost investment in human and physical infrastructure, elevate educational standards and revamp vocational training, unclog and remarketize investment decisions by simplifying federal taxes and state and local regulations. Reform labor management relations to incentivize raising productivity and retraining redundant employees as an alternative to firing them and outsourcing their work to foreigners. Study and adopt foreign best practices, including for medical insurance and services. Sharpen our wits. Ramp up our game and strive for excellence in statecraft and diplomacy as an alternative to counterproductive efforts at military coercion of our rivals, as well as our allies, partners, and friends. Somewhere in the cold dark of Maine in this season, or elsewhere in our vast country, there is someone who sees what we need and can lead us. Americans await this leadership. We know it's out there. It is sorely needed. It is what is required to make America great again. And that is an objective we all share. It's time we stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look, what's going down? Thank you.
That was wonderful. Good. Thank you very much, Natalie. Please come up.
We've been listening to a presentation by Ambassador Chaz Freeman made at the 2018 Camden Conference here on WERU-FM, 89.9 in Blue Hill, 99.9 in Bangor, and on the web at weru.org. Ambassador Freeman's talk was entitled, This Too Shall Pass. Following his presentation, there was a question and answer session with Ambassador Freeman and Natalie Nugared, who gave the presentation preceding Chaz Freeman's. Nathalie Nougared is the past editor of Le Monde, one of France's premier newspapers, and is currently a columnist and commentator for The Guardian newspaper in Great Britain. The session was moderated by Indira Lakshmanan. Here are excerpts from that session, edited for Time.
Well, that's wonderful. Our first standing ovation of the weekend, and very well deserved. Thank you so much, Ambassador Freeman. I want to start out by just playing off of the end of what you just said, Ambassador Freeman. I'm struck that we don't know yet who this putative savior is, who you mentioned, who's going to come make everything right again and turn things around. So I want to ask you, since we're talking about citizen engagement this weekend, how can we, as engaged citizens, become our own saviors and minimize the damage to the world order in the meantime?
Well, I don't think there's anything immediate that can be done to turn around what is a long process. But if you don't start, you'll never get anywhere. And I think the first thing is citizen participation. Over 40% of Americans don't vote. Apathy is the fundamental prop of a static, stagnant society. Those 40% of Americans, some of whom did turn out in the last election to vote for Mr. Trump out of disgust with the stagnation in the country, need to be mobilized and inspired. And I think, as I said, we need to begin to study at the citizen level foreign best practices. I have to say, every time I hear a Congress critter proclaim that a single-payer health insurance system cannot possibly work, I ask how come it does in another 30 industrial democracies. Whether you like that as a solution or not, let's not start from a false premise as we consider the question. And I would say also, and picking up on something Thea said yesterday, that I look at industrial employment, which is a real problem. Less than 8% of American workers are now engaged in industry, manufacturing. If you look at Germany or Japan, you'll find it's somewhat more than 20%. Those societies are more automated than ours. This is counterintuitive. Why? What explains it? Well, if you go to Germany, labor unions have a seat on the management committee in corporations. So when the corporation faces pressure from competition, cheaper prices, perhaps better products, its response is not what American corporations usually do, which is to say, oh, we better lower labor costs by moving to Bangladesh. It is to say, to ask the question, how do we automate and retrain our existing workforce to be more competitive? We need to look at labor management relations in light of the experience of other countries. And the days when we can sit here in North America and imagine that we have all the answers and nobody else has any are long gone.
Let me ask you, again, playing off of that, in your speech, you used the phrase, foreign policy is not about taking names, and that there's this dangerous trend towards machismo, and again, you referenced the Red Scare and McCarthyism and all of that. So specifically on the question of foreign policy, the taking names is obviously a reference to Nikki Haley, our UN ambassador, who said that anyone who voted against the United States' wishes, she'd be taking names and remembering them and acting against them, presumably. So instead of this punitive approach to foreign policy, which is sort of the thread that ran through your entire speech, that we impose rules on others that we don't ourselves obey, again, we're not the people in the positions of power here, but what can we do to possibly influence the Trump administration's foreign policy, which it sounds from your speech is going further down the road of bad policy that you have described?
Diplomacy is not just a strategic maneuver or the tactics of foreign policy. It is also risk management and the day-to-day management of a process which enlists others and encourages attitudes favorable to their cooperating with you. We are eviscerating our diplomatic establishment. Many, many positions that are important, some that are not important, are vacant. The transition, the presidential transition, which began in 2016 and supposedly should have been over last year, is entirely incomplete. We have a Secretary of State in an administration that is radically reducing expenditures on soft power. I don't like that term, by the way, but let's say diplomacy, while ramping up expenditures for new nuclear weapons, just what we need. I don't think new nuclear weapons are going to do anything to gain us the cooperation of trading partners or encourage them to negotiate new rules with us that favor employment growth here as well as there. So I would argue, let's look at what's happening, see if we can penetrate the fog of falsehoods that now clog our media vision.
All right, and I'm just going to ask one question of Natalie. So Natalie, you know, coming out of your talk, I guess I want to ask, you have a lot of personal experience in Russia as a reporter, and you referenced our own situation here in the United States where there's an obsession with Russia, the Russia probe, how Russia interfered in our election, the 13 indictments on the individuals and the three entities. So give us the European perspective of how do you guys view Russia and its interference in our election?
The European picture on Russia is complex because there are different sensitivities within Europe to Russia as a neighbor. Poles don't relate to Russia and don't think about Russia in the same way that the French do, or certainly the Spanish, or the British. There's a history that's different. There are very strong contrasts. But I think that by now, after what happened in 2014, which was the first changing of borders, unilateral changing of borders on the European continent through use of force with the annexation of Crimea, that was a tipping point. It wasn't just war that was coming back to Europe, it was that changing of borders through use of force. And that raised really big red flags in Europe. So I think there's a growing, since then, there's been a growing assessment that Russia is a revisionist power on the European continent. It wants to somehow rewrite some of the rules that were created in the post-war and then post-Cold War era. It's doing so in sometimes confusing ways. It's playing hot and cold sometimes. But that, I think that assessment is growing. So when you think about that, meddling in elections becomes slightly, it's an important thing. Okay, it needs to be documented. It needs to, everything needs to be, clarified and dealt with. But that particular question of Russian revisionism, as an assessment today that's fairly widely shared in Europe is the big overarching challenge.
Okay, and we need to get to questions, but I know Chaz wanted to jump in.
Very quickly, I agree with Natalie that the issue of Russian revisionism is the central question. But I would like to point out that Ukraine and Crimea were not the first change of borders by violence. That was Kosovo. And it was a direct challenge to Russian interests, and I think it had something to do with inspiring the Russians in Crimea. A broader point, what question you ask determines what answers you consider. If the question is how to prevent Russia from fooling around in our sphere of influence, how to push our borders up to Russia's, how to ensure that Ukraine is on our side, then you get one set of responses. If the question is a different one, illustrated by history, for example, 1815, revolutionary France is defeated. The victors very sensibly convene the Congress of Vienna, and they reincorporate France into the councils of government in Europe. They make it part of the system. And for 100 years, there's very little war in Europe until 1914. World War I finishes, and the victors do something quite different. They exclude Germany from a role in participating in European affairs, and they allow the Bolshevik regime in Moscow to exclude itself. That didn't work out very well. It caused World War II. It led directly to the Cold War. So perhaps we should be asking a different question with regard to Russia. How do we incorporate Russia into a positive role in governing a common space? How do we make Ukraine a viable state that is both a buffer and a bridge between Russia and the rest of Europe? How do we deal with Russia, not how do we exclude Russia? If you ask those questions, you begin to look at other answers. And I think it wouldn't be a bad idea to reframe some of the questions we're asking ourselves.
We could have an entire conference on NATO expansionism and how NATO expansionism may have encouraged Russia in, but yeah. we also want to get to questions. So I'm going to prevail upon the audience to please be generous by making your questions brief, and I'll ask our speakers to make their answers pithy so we can try to get as many people as possible. All right, let's start here.
With the goal of working toward a workable electing a functional Congress in both identifying, some common grounds and some unholy alliances, whatever. How does pushing for things I happen to believe in, like single payer or gun control, how does pursuing those goals, will it help to unify or further divide our government?
Depends on who we elect and whether they are committed to making our constitutional system work or not. We do not have a parliamentary system. In a parliamentary system, winner takes all and can ignore the opposition. That is not the way a separation of powers government works. We have to compromise across the aisle. Everyone who votes for someone who says, "I will never compromise," is contributing to gridlock. So my answer is we need to go back to representative government in which representatives are expected to exercise independent judgment in accordance with the broad will of the people. We need to restore the Constitution, by the way. Article 1, Section 8, Clause 11, very deliberately assigned the power to launch wars of choice to the U.S. Congress. The president does not have that constitutional authority. And yet we're now engaged in 9 wars, all of them presidentially proclaimed. We have a Bill of Rights, some of which is apparently in suspense. We need to restore our traditional values. And that, I think, gets to this next question.
Yeah, let's get that question, which was from one of our satellite locations. Norman Rapkin in Portland wants to know, how can the U.S. regain the international stature it had years ago? Natalie, start us off briefly with the answer from a European point of view, and I think you also wanted to add something about reframing the question on Russia.
I would say the first thing is to get back into multilateralism, to say that, the U.S. wants to reach out to partners and work together and break away from this sense that it is going alone, so it is going it alone somehow.
But let me challenge you on that.
Yeah.
During 8 years of the Obama administration, we were supposedly reaching out to our multilateral partners, and the premise of this question is the stature we had years ago, which I take to mean that the questioner does not think we had that stature during the Obama administration. So does the multilateralism that the Obama administration engaged in, is that really just the answer?
Well, I mean, it was a big part of the answer, yeah. I mean, think back at where the U.S.'s image was in 2008, I mean, its image had been damaged. Chas mentioned Guantanamo. In Europe, the image of the USA had been severely damaged by a lot of things. Iraq, Guantanamo, a lot of things.
Of course, so I think Obama administration did not shut down Guantanamo.
No,
it still exists.
And everything's complex because, having said that, as a European, yes, we criticize Guantanamo, but remember European governments, some of them were involved in those networks of CIA.
The black sites.
Sites in Poland, namely in Lithuania. So it's a complex picture.
Okay, let's take one more question from one of the satellite locations. And I just want to remind everyone, you will have a chance to ask questions of Natalie and Chaz in the final group panel. So Lisa Dalton of Rockland wants to know, what are Turkey's chances of joining the EU? Okay, so quick response from both of you. First you, Natalie, since you're
zero.
Okay, that's a quick answer.
I agree.
All right. That gives us time. That gives us time for one more question. Well done, folks. All right, one more question. Should we take one more here? Okay, there's one right up there in the balcony.
Hi, John Campo, University of Maine. And Natalie, you seem to suggest that the Obama administration made a mistake in Syria. And I was just wondering, considering our failures in Iraq and Libya and our the regains of the Taliban in Afghanistan, how would Syria be different?
I think the short answer is that all these situations are different. And one of the difficulties we have today in getting our minds around these issues is seeing those complexities and seeing those differences. In fact, every single case of an intervention is a specific case. And we haven't, you know, we need to try to go back on how things happened and not lump everything together. The fact that outcomes weren't those that were expected, whether we intervened or did not intervene, does not lead to the automatic conclusion that any intervention is always a complete failure. I think Bosnia is an example of a place where intervention did play a role. I think Rwanda and Syria today, in different contexts, are examples where failure to act at the right time in a smart way led to huge amounts of human suffering and regional destabilization. Probably I don't have time to get into the details, but I think there are differences between Libya and there are and Syria, just as there are differences between Afghanistan. And you know, remember, Iraq is almost a very specific case because this was a land invasion. This was a land invasion. No authorization whatsoever by the UN Security Council. So Iraq kind of, as Chas said, it kind of, you know, broke that taboo of, it was like the first moment where the US was blatantly running acting against rules that it itself had contributed to build up. And Iraq is definitely a turning point. But don't lump all these interventions, you know, as you look back to the 90s, into a single bag. It's a more complex thing. I think that there was an opportunity in Syria. It's my belief. I think there was an opportunity in Syria in the summer of 2013 to do something that might have led to a negotiated solution.
Through diplomatic led or using force in some way?
What I said is through targeted strikes. The opposition,
after the red line was crossed.
The opposition in Syria in the summer of 2013 was in a much better place than it was later. That doesn't mean there was going to be military regime change with people invading, you know, the presidential palace in Damascus and U.S. Marines landing. That was never the plan. When the people from the Obama administration are slightly disingenuous when I listen to them still today, you know, saying, well, you know, there's no way we're going to repeat Iraq. That was never the plan in Syria. And so I think that at that moment when the Assad regime was still in the early phases of that war, you know, it's been going on for 2 years by that time, might have been pushed towards the negotiating table. The Russians were almost out of the picture. They're tightly connected to the Syrian regime, and they have been for decades, but they were out of the picture as active military actors on the ground.
We are going to take a break for half an hour.
We've just heard some excerpts from a question and answer session at the 2018 Camden Conference, moderated by Indira Lakshmanan and featuring Natalie Nugared and Ambassador Chas Freeman, whose presentation we heard in full in the first half of today's program. This program and all of the programs produced by WERU from the 2018 Camden Conference are available for listening on demand on the web at weru.org. For more information about the Camden Conference, please go to camdenconference.org. Thanks for listening, and tune in for future presentations on WERU from the 2018 Camden Conference.